Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and today we continue counting down our 100 favorite movies of all time up to number 32, episode number 69, and we're talking about Once Upon a Time in the West and Man with a Movie Camera, two old movies. And John, something really hit me this week that really disturbed me. Once Upon a Time in the West was Man with a Movie Camera was 39 years old when Once Upon a Time in the West came out. Once Upon a Time in the West is 54 years old right now. So Once Upon a Time in the West has been around for 54 years and is only, what is it? What did I just say? 39 years older than Man with a Movie Camera. Yeah. That's a weird thing to think about, to see where movies went from in 1929 to 1968. And now we're like further away from 68 than Once Upon a Time in the West was from Man with a Movie Camera. Man with a Movie Camera is barely even a movie, considering everything, you know, the score is all added in after and everything like that. There's no dialogue. He even says there's no characters, all that stuff. It's funny to see how far things came, because 1968 is closer to 1929 than we are to 1968.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where you kind of just have this realization of how time works and you're not too happy about it.
Yeah, it's a sad thing. It's not my favorite in the entire world. But this kicks off a streak for me of back-to-back 1968 movies, and then I will have two more 1968 movies coming up in the near future, although one of them gets replaced because it's Space Odyssey and John has that higher on his list. Of course, with Man with a Movie Camera, it's just John, of course, doing his 1920s Russian thing because that's what John does. Man with a Movie Camera, and both of these movies are interesting.
Yeah,
because I do feel that these are two movies where like it's like an appreciation for cinema thing. I watched like Werkmeister Harmonies this week, and I watched Vera Diana, which is the Louis Buñuel movie. And I watched both of those this week, and like I loved both of them. Like I really, really enjoyed both of them. I thought they were both 4-star movies, whatever. But then I was like, if you don't love movies, you don't like this movie. Like you don't want to sit down and watch either one of these movies. And I do feel like Once Upon a Time in the West, the first time I watched it, I remember just being so taken back by it that I was like, man, this is like, how could anybody not love this movie? And then watching it this time, which I think this was the second or third time, probably the second time I watched it in its entirety, rather than kind of like broken up or anything. Mm-hmm. It was funny because I was like, man, this is such a freaking art house Western. And of course, this is only going to be loved by like cinephiles and things like that. I think it's epic. It's not really moving much on my list. It might move up, down. I don't know. It's going to depend on kind of how I'm feeling in the mood when I go to make the new list. But that's what this is. And Man with a Movie Camera, this is a movie that I watched way back in college and just did not appreciate at all. And it just really hit me differently this time. So I just think it's fun that like, you know, this is like a cinephile type thing, as opposed to when we did last week, the Royal Tenenbaums, or 2 weeks, I'm sorry. Yeah. Last week we did Blair Witch and Taxi Driver. And the week before that we did Royal Tenenbaums and Halloween. That's not necessarily like Royal Tenenbaums and Halloween. You don't have to be cinephiles to like those movies. Those are movies that anybody can really sit down and watch. I really do think that these two movies kind of test the patience and kind of really advance the art, because Man with a Movie Camera, for obvious reasons, but Once Upon a Time in the West is a Western really unlike any other. I don't care what anybody says. And I think it has the greatest score in film history, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I mean, both of these films are incredibly important in what they do for film in general. Obviously, like what Sergio Leone was doing in Italy with the spaghetti westerns was huge, especially when you consider it was like more towards like the end of westerns being really massive with audiences. And then what Vertov's doing with Man with a Movie Camera is just, he's presenting his own film thesis essentially to us in a way where he just says, hey, I have this idea. It's called Cinema Verite. This is it. Mm-hmm. I hope you like it. And it was one of those things that was like really divisive when it came out, because some people are like, okay, but what's happening?
Well, I mean, not for nothing, like Man with a Movie Camera should be a snooze. Especially when you watch it in today's day and age. It's 2022. This movie's 93 years old. Most things that are 93 years old, we really don't have much of an appreciation for anymore, John. Like that's just how it is. Like most things that are 93 years old just don't really do it for us anymore. And I think that this movie kind of showed, it shows that you can stand the test of time with really good ideas by just having really good ideas. And it's funny because there's so many books that you'll read or that people say, you got to read this one. And then you read it and you're like, why did I have to read that book? Like, what was so special about that book that I couldn't have just like read something more modern? Like, I don't care about, you know, older British, you know, literature. Like, it doesn't do it for me. But something like Man with a Movie Camera, it shows that, like, yeah, there's a lot of bad stuff that came out in the 1920s. Like, a lot of bad movies. In the 1930s, I've been watching a couple 1930s movies. There's a lot of bad movies that really shouldn't be, like, held in any type of – in anything. But this was just, like – it just – it's something different. But you have to be in the mindset of what you're looking at. And I think that was the hardest thing for me as a college student. I think this is the hardest thing for a lot of people when it comes to Man with a Movie Camera. And a lot of these older movies that they're kind of force-fed down your throat when you do study film or anything like that – but Man with a Movie Camera has something special that, in my opinion, a lot of those other movies don't have. And we'll talk about that as we go. But since it's your movie, why don't we start off with it? Because it's obviously less popular than Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yes. Yeah. And what it comes down to is this movie, it's just this love letter to film and cinema in a time when film and cinema was just really in its infancy. Mm-hmm. Like, we're in 28 and... like, the Soviet Union's at a point now where it's saying film is our main form of art. Like, that is the main type of art we're going to produce. Lenin held in high regards. And we've talked about what film was doing in the Soviet Union this time. We talked about Eisenstein already with Battleship Potemkin. But what Vertov did was like, hey, we have all these film theories about, like, montage and everything going on right now. I think we can do that, and we can make this observational documentary. It's the only documentary you have on either of our top 100s. Mm-hmm. And he just said, we can make this movie that has nothing, like no intertitles, no scenario, no plot, no characters. We can make that. We can show people just day-to-day life and a person capturing that day-to-day life. And it can be interesting. And the fact that this movie is presented in a time where, like, sound and movies aren't synced up, and it had a score that was improvised, essentially, by the piano player who was playing it based on Vertov's notes to that piano player. Mm-hmm. It just makes it so interesting because you could watch this movie hundreds of times and never have the exact experience every time you see it.
Well, and really probably the purest way to watch this movie is to turn the sound off and just sit down and actually watch it. Now, I would never do that because I don't have the patience. And I like the operatic score that Nyman had put into this. That's the one I watched. I think you said you watched the same one because we wanted to make sure we had the same one. But I thought he did a really – like, I think it's just a beautiful score that goes along with this movie. But this is what I'm saying with, like, you have to put yourself in the mind. You said this was a documentary. I don't think this is a documentary, and this is why documentaries still have a story. Like, they still have, like, something that they're trying to say. And I understand that this has to be categorized as documentary. But what I'm saying is, like, if you were to say to somebody, this is a documentary, and arguably this is the first documentary ever made, you sit down and be like, well, what was the point? But I think what this really is, and what hit me so hard this time, is this is – we had photographs. You know, back in the 1800s, they had those photographs where you had to pose for 4 hours and then finally it would take your picture. But we had photographs. And this was, okay, now I can show you what's happening in between the photograph. And I really think that one of the most brilliant moments maybe ever is when he does the still photos, because we've seen still photos. Even in 1929, they had seen still photos. And then he goes back and he shows what was happening before and after those photos. And it's like, holy shit. You can now see what's happening aside from that one still frame. That one still frame is there, and if you blink, you're going to miss it. But look at what was leading up to that, and was it what you thought was leading up to that? That's where you're telling the story. I almost feel like this is a bunch of short films that are just about – like, it's short subject documentaries, essentially. Mm-hmm. But it's – we're in the coal mine. We're having the scene where the birth is being given. We have that picture scene. Like, we have the divorce and the marriage and all that. Like, it is like a bunch of short films that are stuck together, and he's claiming there's no story, but there is a story, and it's just the story of this was Russia. What hit me so emotionally this time was we got to see authentic 1929 human beings in Russia moving around. That does not happen in film in any medium now, because, or in any genre now, because there is always a director who is pushing you in one way or another. In a documentary, somebody is asking you a question. Somebody is telling the story, is editing it together to make you feel emotionally one way or the other. Blackfish, which so many people like, great. If you like it, good for you. I don't like Blackfish. I think Blackfish is dumb, and I think it's trying so hard to push you in an emotional way. But at the same time, that is the purpose of that. Same thing with what? Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. That is pushing you one way. Anything by Michael Moore. Like, you could go on and on and on. He's not trying to push you anywhere with this. He just wants you to see it. And I think that was what was so stunning to me, is those were real people just going about their everyday lives and not even realizing that 93 years later, people would be looking at them having no idea who they were, no idea what their lives were, but they were just as – their lives were just as real as the people who post on Instagram and TikTok every 5 minutes of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a – it's just such a captivating experience to, like, see this type of thing. Like, we have a couple of examples of, like, similar films that have been made over the years, something like Koyaanisqatsi in the 80s. There was an observational documentary that was up for best feature-length documentary this year at the Oscars, Ascension, which I felt like the first half of that movie really captured, like, the spirit of, like, Man with a Movie Camera. But then the second half really did do what you were saying, where it was really forcing you into, like, believing a very particular truth and, like, wanting you to feel a certain way. But Vertov doesn't do that. Vertov's just showing you different film techniques throughout this entire movie. And the fact that, like, we don't have the original score, that we don't have this original score that, because music drives emotion when you're watching, when it's with images, or just in general, music drives emotion. And that's the big thing. You can, even when you're watching the version with the Nyman score, there are those moments where you're just like, yeah, let's go. Like, you're amped up because of the way the score is going. When like that bassoon line starts, you're like, ooh.
I get the operatic part every time. When the woman's voice kicks in, I'm like, damn, kill me. I can't even watch this. Like, it make me that emotional.
Yeah. And it really just goes to show the power of cinema. And that's what really pulls me into this movie. Where, yeah, the first time I watched this movie was also in a college class. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And, like, the more I revisit it, the more I realize how much I just appreciate what it is and what it's become. Because Vertov just does everything in this film. The two, like, actors in this movie are just his brother and his wife. His brother being the person carrying the movie camera around the entire time. Okay. And his wife being the person who's editing the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels so real this entire time, because despite the fact that they are, like, acting per se, they're still doing things for the creation of this film that they'd be doing anyways. Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating. The technique Vertov puts into this film and just the decisions. He has scenes that are sped up. He has scenes that are slowed down. He has scenes that are, like, superimposed on top of other scenes. He uses montage. He uses, like, every film technique under the sun available to him in 1929. And it just creates this beautiful artistic piece that just captures life in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. And you know, I even think nowadays, like, you're talking about Ascension and then you're talking about the other movie, but, like, the problem is now people know what it means to be on camera. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the same thing. Like, I just got married back in May. When you, as soon as you realize the photographer was there, or, like, the cameraman was there, you immediately start to act differently. There's nothing you can do about it. Because you know that you're being photographed or that a video is being taken of you. You can't help it. You're not acting natural. That's why, like, there's that whole, like, voyeur thing. Like, if you got a camera, there's a camera in the corner of the room right now and it was working. Yeah, I am acting natural because I don't know what's going on. I don't know that that's happening. But once you know it's there, it changes everything. And I think that's why Man with a Movie Camera really is a one of a kind and will never be duplicated because these people didn't know what was happening. They had no idea. They probably thought this guy was a nut job carrying around this 500-pound piece of equipment or whatever it was at the time. It was definitely heavy. Carrying it around and, like, just saying, hey, I want to film you getting your – or I want to take a video of you getting your divorce. They don't know what the hell that means. They didn't know what that meant. Like, and I think that's what's so fascinating about this, though, is you didn't know what it meant. You – nowadays, you can't do it because as soon as you know that something's happening, you know you're getting out there in the air. It's the same thing. You watch all these freaking, like, gotcha moments from politics or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Everybody know they're doing it for a purpose. Anytime somebody reacts to somebody or chases somebody or whatever it is, whoever is holding that phone, that camera, taking a video, knows that there's a greater purpose to why they're taking that video. That's not the case with Man with a Movie Camera. With Man with a Movie Camera, that is the most authentic way you're going to get people. I almost think of it, Man with a Movie Camera is like when you, if you went on a family vacation back in the 90s before everybody had their phones and they had, and you had like your dad just walking around being like, oh, we're going to document this. Maybe your family wasn't being authentic, but every person around you was, because every person around you didn't know who you were, didn't care that you had a camera and was just going about their day. I met that all the time. My dad has freaking video of us from 1998 in Disney World. There's people in that video that are in my home video that whenever we turn that on, if we throw that on Christmas, we got my mom the DVDs for one Christmas, throw those on Christmas. Those people from 1990, I don't know if they're dead, alive, I don't care. But the thing is, they are acting authentically. And there are people in those videos where, like, I would point out, I would say to my dad, oh, that's the guy in Splash Mountain who's going to turn around and kind of do like a laugh. I could show you that video right now and you'd say, wow, that's the guy you were talking about. Because that's the impact it has. But it's funny because I don't know who the hell that person is and I never will.
Yeah.
That's authentic. You just can't get to this level of authenticity anymore because everybody's putting on a show at this point. It's kind of like we all live in an Almodovar movie, whatever. Almodovar, however you pronounce his name. We live in his movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And the beauty of Man with a Movie Camera is that Vertov doesn't just present it strictly as, you know, the daily life aspect of it, because the amount of artistry he puts into it and connecting these scenes is phenomenal. We get that opening sequence where it's everyone like piling into the theater, and like it's setting the excitement, right? It's like, okay, everyone's getting excited to watch this, and then you watch it and it's kind of these like these desolate streets and empty streets and stores and everything. And you slowly get to feel the city wake up. And then he gets bustling. And then everything's happening. And then he slows it down with some of these ideas with, like, that film editing scene where we get the still. And then we get the shot of the before and after of that still. And the best part about that, which I noticed for the first time on this viewing, every single one of those stills comes up later in the film.
Yeah. Yep.
It's just this beautiful artistry that Vertov's put together, and he really didn't care what people thought about it.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing too. Like I find nowadays so fun. I watched Sayonara, which is 1957 Marlon Brando movie. So I've been going through trying to watch all those Best Picture nominees, and that was one of them. I just watched it today. You go on Letterboxd, every review is about how racist the movie is. Well, it's a 1957 movie that's dealing with interracial marriage between white people and Japanese people. And not for nothing, it's handling it pretty well. And then the American army is saying racist things about it. So is the movie racist, or is it the story that is, or is it just showing the racism of the time?
Racism, yeah.
And I think that's where, like, so like nowadays, any movie that tries to deal with race in the 50s or the 60s, or the, every Sidney Poitier movie at this point is, oh man, that's such a racist depiction of a black man. But it's at the time, it was actually doing positive things for relations between races. Like, it was good. And I think it's hard to put yourself in those shoes. And what I think with Man with a Movie Camera is it's a hard movie to critique in that way. Mm-hmm. Man with a Movie Camera is doing a lot, but you can't sit down and say, oh, that's an outdated depiction of race relations. Or that is, you know, what is it? Fred Astaire with Holiday Inn when he's in blackface. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not going to be deleted from the movie. And if that is, that's weird because that's censorship. But that was happening at the time and nobody thought twice about it. It was, that's what we're going to do. With Man with a Movie Camera, it doesn't have to worry about that stuff. And I think that's why it's so timeless, because it wasn't trying, like any movie from 1929 now, I mean, go watch any Rudolph Valentino movie if you can find them, because they all got burned. But if you can find them, he plays Egyptians, he plays whatever the hell he can get his hands on, because that's what his role is. And I just think that, like, with Man with a Movie Camera not having to deal with that and being so pure and authentic, this is no one's interpretation of what life was like or how life was going to improve because of this movie. This was just a movie. And I think about that all the time, because even when we talk about now new school documentaries, does Michael Moore ever regret anything that he said? I don't know, but maybe. Does Al Gore with Inconvenient Truth? I never watched it, but like, I don't know what was said in that. I'm sure that a lot of things he said were going to happen haven't happened yet. So like, does he think like, does he ever second guess that? And that's what I'm just saying, like with this movie, Vertov, he didn't have to second guess anything. And nobody is second guessing what he put out there, because he just put out a pure, authentic piece of film. I just don't know how to describe it. And it's funny to me, because I really thought that I was going to come into this today, John, with like a 2-star review making fun of you for the fact that you had this in your top 100. And I'm not.
Yeah. No, it's a movie. It's a film that just kind of catches you off guard. If you like haven't watched it in a while, or like the last time you watched it was you were being forced to watch it. Mm-hmm. And when you just sit there and you watch it as a film itself, it kind of just says why you love film. Because it's just showing you why the art form is so versatile and what it can do. The authenticity of it all, that's why, I mean, we talked about the BFI last week a little bit. BFI has this ranked as like the 8th best movie ever made. They say it's the best documentary ever made. Mm-hmm. It's just that observation and just being able to put yourself into another time period. We often say that film like can act like a time machine and it can transport you to another time period where, like you said, things are being done differently. Like they're depicting the racial treatment of people in a different time period and stuff. Nothing can truly capture that like the way a Man with a Movie Camera does, because this is a Soviet movie. Would you know that watching this movie?
No, it doesn't matter. It could be San Francisco. You don't know. Yeah. It's got the trolleys going down the street. Maybe that's San Francisco in 1929. It doesn't matter. And I think I really do think that this might be one of the most universal movies ever made because of that, because it doesn't matter where this is taking place. It just is taking place. And you know, when you watch this almost 100 years in the future, look at the technology that they thought they had and look at where we are now. While that birthing scene was happening, all I could think was she had no painkillers. Like she just literally, like that was a natural birth. Nowadays, like that's not happening very often. And I just thought like that was, it's so fascinating to see that and look at it. And it is like looking through pictures. When I went up to my grandmother's last summer and she was going through pictures because my grandfather had died and she's going through pictures. And she had a picture of her father. Now, my grandma's 89 years old right now, so she was 88 last year. Her father, as a baby, on the lap of his mother. And it was a picture. And I said to her, I'm like, do you realize that that woman was probably born in like 1880, 1890, and she's in this photograph? Like, and that to me is like what Man with a Movie Camera is. Half the people in this, how old are these people? Are we looking at people who were born in 1860, 1870, who never could be captured as real humans other than through paintings or pictures or whatever? Like, we don't realize as a generation how new it is to be able to, I'm moving. Yeah. You can see me moving. We don't realize as a generation how new that is, because we are so used to it and it's been such a part of our lives. We might not have had the internet our whole lives, but we had videos, we had DVDs, we had all that stuff. When you have people who were born in 1890, they didn't know this stuff. They didn't see this stuff. And I just think that's why a movie like this is just such a time capsule. And it's 93 years old, which seems really old, but film had only been around for maybe 30, 40 years prior to that, depending on what you count as film. What the zoetrope was in the 1870s or 1860s, whatever it was. Like, you're talking not even 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. And this movie's 93 years old. This was Instagram back in the day, guys. Like, this was the extent of it. It's just a fascinating thing to think about. But again, why Man with a Movie Camera works for people like us and isn't going to get us 7,000 views on this, like if we were to do an Avengers review, is because how do you have to get in that mindset, and how do you get into that mindset, and how do you really sit down and say to yourself, I am going to just take this for what it is and appreciate it for what it is. That's a hard thing to do. And it took me till I was 30 years old to actually be able to sit down and do that. And maybe it wouldn't have worked that way if I didn't sit down at 11 o'clock at night and throw it on. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those weird things with film is everything about when you watch something matters. And I feel like the fact that we've been discussing, you know, this is our 69th episode of the podcast, the fact that we've been doing this almost every week for a year and a half now, it puts us in that mindset where we can really appreciate this type of film. And there are a lot of people out there. I showed this to my roommate who, you know, enjoys film, but doesn't enjoy the same type of films you and I like. But he still enjoyed this one because he could understand the artistry of it. Mm-hmm. But if you show this to someone who just like watches Avengers movies all the time, they're not going to like this film.
No.
They're going to be like, what is the point of this film? And part of the beauty of this film is being able to explain why this film's good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because like this is not an entertaining movie, and neither one of us is going to argue that it's entertaining, but it is deep, and it's just like it's what do you like? You know what I mean? It's what do you value? Are you somebody who sits at home and listens to classical music, listens to top 40, listens to indie, listens to classic rock? None of those are right. None of those are wrong. But which one are you? Like what do you prefer? And that's the same thing with movies. What do you prefer? And I just think with this, like, man, I did not prefer this type of movie back when I was 18, 19, 20 years old. Now I appreciate it. And now it's a quick hour with a beautiful score. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's visuals to have on. Like it is fascinating. And I really appreciated it this time. And I get why it has built up such a cult following over the past decade or so, because it really has built up a massive cult following.
Yeah, it's definitely been more in like the public eye in the last decade or so. A lot of that has to do with just like distribution of it, because it's a movie that was hard to kind of get before until like, you know, Moss Films opened up all of their archives so you could just watch everything on their website. Places like Canopy get a hold of it. And then also just I looked into the score history of this film today. There are like 50 different versions of this movie.
Oh, I believe it.
And until this particular, like the Nyman score came out in 2002, none of them were in multiple copies.
Nice.
The Nyman score is in like 100 different copies of Man with the Movie Camera, but there are hundreds more out there that are just different scores. And yeah, they're somewhat similar, but they're all a different personal interpretation based on the person who is interpreting these notes from Vertov on what's supposed to be happening in conjunction with the images on the screen. Yeah. That in itself is just so fascinating. And the fact that we are now living in a time period where so many people can explore this art from nearly 100 years ago is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm glad I got to sit down and watch, because this was a movie that if we didn't do this podcast, I would have never watched it again. Never. Yeah. Same thing with Battleship Potemkin, though. Like, I would have never gotten around to them because they were things that were rammed down our throats. And I was just like, whatever. Yep. I'm not into it. I don't care. So I'm happy that we did sit down, watch this movie, and, you know, that I can now have a newfound appreciation for it. But anything else you want to say before we move on to the next one?
No, I'm impressed we were able to talk half an hour about this movie in the first place.
I didn't think we were going to. Yeah. Well done. All right. Well, let's jump over. What was the best movie you watched this week?
I only watched one other movie this week.
Nice.
That and makes it easy. That was Jordan Peele's Nope. It was good. I enjoyed it. It wasn't, I would not call this so as much a horror movie as his previous two films. This, in all honesty, this gave me a lot of more like 70s, like late 70s, early 80s sci-fi vibes, and felt more in line with like Close Encounters of the Third Kind mm-hmm. than it did like a horror movie, which is fine. I think I need to watch it again to fully, with that in mind, to fully appreciate it.
Yeah. I'll check it out eventually. I didn't get around to it. Also, like, movie-going audiences in Miami and South Florida just in general aren't the greatest. So I don't want to go see a really popular Jordan Peele movie on opening weekend. So I'm definitely going to wait it out, and then I'll see it. I'll see it at some point, probably in the next week or two. I watched a couple great ones, man. Like, I rewatched Nobody, which holds up, and I still freaking love that movie. I don't care what anybody says. I do want to give a quick shout-out to – I've been ranking the best actor, supporting actress, and actress – Oscar winners, just to kind of give myself like an idea. I will say that this week I watched the worst one for a best supporting actor, which is funny because we're about to talk about him. But Jason Robards in Julia does nothing and is in maybe 4 minutes of the movie and doesn't do anything except talk like Jason Robards does in every other movie. And I was like, so he beat Alec Guinness for Star Wars, which I never thought I would really complain that Alec Guinness didn't win as Obi-Wan Kenobi because it's more of the icon than the acting. What in the F was going on, man? Seriously, watch Julia, not because it's good, because I certainly do not like that movie, but sit down and watch that movie and tell me why the hell Jason Robards won the Oscar. I couldn't tell you. It was wild. But anyway, I watched I finally got around to watching Top Hat, which is the old Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movie. Absolutely holds up. The best one of their of that duo by far. I've watched Swing Time, Top Hat, and The Gay Divorcee because it was like their first one, the one that was on AFI's, and then Top Hat is considered their classic. Top Hat is their classic. It's a very fun movie, which is what those are supposed to be. Really fun story that then just breaks away so they can dance every now and then. I was totally on board with it. But Werkmeister Harmonies was freaking awesome. Like Werkmeister Harmonies, that was my first Bellatar movie. I know that will make John happy. It was only 2 hours and 19 minutes. So I guess I'm a fraud, but it just like, he's so purposeful. And I know, you know, mm-hmm. that, but I think the most profound thing I saw about this was I read Roger Ebert's review for it in 2007. So Ebert waited 7 years to see this movie. And I think it was his first Bellatar movie. And in there he said it's 39 shots. And the average length of the shot is 3.7 minutes. As compared to a very popular movie that year, The Bourne Identity, the average length of the shot was 1.9 seconds.
Yeah.
3.7 minutes, 1.9 seconds. That is unbelievable. That's unbelievable. So Werkmeister Harmonies, certainly weird, certainly out there, but I was so into it. And there's a scene in a hospital that is just absolutely breathtaking, and Bellatar barely uses score in this movie, but when he does, it is meaningful. I was very much into it. Certainly we'll try to get down to Sot and Tango at some point. Don't know when it's going to happen, but yeah, this was a good intro to Bellatar for sure. I was definitely into this movie, and John, you know, you got to get around to watching it.
I know. I do. It's been one that I've been meaning to get to. I love Bellatar, as we know. I just love his intentionality because, like you said, taking a shot, like having an average shot length of 3 minutes and 17 seconds is absolutely ridiculous. And the fact that he has such intention with it that you're never feeling like it's dragging at all, that it just has you engaged the entire time. It's something not many people can accomplish.
Well, it's funny because I really had to go use the bathroom. So it's funny you say that because I had to use the bathroom and I paused it. And I thought I was 10 minutes into the movie and I was 30 minutes into it. And I said, what? But that's what he does. And that's when you said to me like, oh no, wait, Sot and Tango doesn't feel that long. Like I kind of believe you now.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I'm going to sit down and watch it yet, but we'll get there.
You'll get there. You'll get there.
Eventually. All right. Once Upon a Time in the West from 1968, Sergio Leone. I always say with this movie, I was living in the worst living situation I had in Los Angeles, where I was pretty much Harry Potter in a closet. And so I would, whenever I wanted to watch a movie, my two roommates lived upstairs in the apartment and I was downstairs off the living room. And them and their friends would always come over and they would just like pretty much smoke and sit there. It was like a typical LA hangout. And I always wanted to just watch movies. So the one night they're being real loud, whatever. And I was just like, you know what? Like, not that I was a great roommate, I'm loud too, I'm not trying to complain about that. But one night I was like, you know what? As soon as they all leave, I need to watch a movie. Like, I just need to do whatever. And it was like 11 o'clock at night. And I said, well, Once Upon a Time in the West is free on Amazon Prime. I don't really like Westerns. That's always been a thing for me. So I was like, let me just throw it on. And I threw it on. And the next thing I knew, it was 1:30 in the morning and I was finishing up the movie. I really thought that I was going to be watching about a half hour to an hour of that movie and then starting it over again the next day. And it's actually given me a much greater appreciation for other Westerns like The Great Silence or Bandidos, which I talked about a couple weeks ago. What is the one? There's one, Django, a man named Django or a man called Django, whatever it is. Like, they all have so many different names because it's the Italian name, the Spanish name, the English name, whatever. But it gave me such an appreciation. But what I just was so blown away by with this movie, and I'd never seen it before, and everybody's, well, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Yeah. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly has an epic score. But The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with its epicness is so still of like the Western genre, in my opinion. This, to me, transcended what the Western genre was going to be. Mm-hmm. The Once Upon a Time in the West main theme, the first time it plays, when Claudia Cardinale comes into the town and the camera just goes up and it gets into that opera, it gives me chills talking about it right now.
Yeah.
It just did something that I'd never seen in this genre before. I love the story, as convoluted and all over the place as it is. It's a spaghetti. It's supposed to be. Henry Fonda as Frank, one of the best villains. I mean, when you kill a kid in the first 10 minutes of a movie, that tells you everything you need to know. I guess it's the first 20 minutes of the movie because the freaking opening is long. Yeah. But when you kill a kid, your first moment on screen, that tells me everything I need to know about your character. And that's going to make me say, okay, let's go. Not, oh, I shot you with a gun from far away. Well, since you said my name, now I have to kill the kid. It's those choices by Leone with Morricone's score, the acting by Robards and Cardinale and Fonda. And then, of course, from Charles Bronson as the man with the harmonica. Like, it's just, it all works so well. And for a 2.5 hour movie, you don't feel like you're sitting down watching a movie for 2.5 hours. Like, it just, it takes its time though. It takes its time. And that's what I was saying earlier. It is an art movie at the end of the day. It takes its sweet ass time getting to where it needs to get. But when it does get to those moments, it nails every single one of them. And it's fun. It's emotional. And it just has great heroes and villains. And that's what Westerns are supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, before I watched this movie for the first time, I hated Westerns. I didn't like them at all. After I've watched so many Westerns in the year and a half since I first watched this. And I love the genre now. I absolutely love Westerns now. Leone just set me completely straight because, and this is still the best of them, is what it comes down to. Because what Leone does in this, he has this understanding of the American West that maybe John Ford's the only person to ever make a movie to have that depth of understanding of the American West. And the symbolism that he shows, the themes that he's putting in these films. The first 15 minutes of this film might be one of the best sequences ever put to film. Hands down. Well,
and what I love about it is you have this very serious, very quiet, not even score. Like, there's really nothing happening.
Yeah.
And then it still has the beautiful spaghetti Western credits that'll just pop up. Pew! Like, it's still in its genre, but you're sitting there going, what are they waiting for? I love the fly. You can't blow the fly away. Like, all of those moments just keep piling up. And it's awesome. Like, it's just so great to see what he is setting up, because by the time the man with the harmonica, the train comes, it throws something off. You're like, okay, they got their package. They go to walk away and you hear the harmonica and they all just freeze. that is such an amazing intro for The Man with the Harmonica, a great intro for this setup that is being planned at this moment to try to pin everything on Cheyenne and his men. Like, even though you don't know who Cheyenne is at this point, but it's coming. Yeah. You know, your good guy, your bad guy, whatever. It's an epic intro. And then you follow it up with, oh, look, a nice family living in a mountain, and they're all dead. And it's it's like, and then you follow that up with the girl that they didn't go to pick up, who, you know, her whole family is dead, getting off the train and now having to ride all the way out into the middle of nowhere to get there to see your family. Like, those are your first three scenes of this movie.
It's unbelievable. It's so impressive. It's the fact that there are two sentences spoken in the first 13 minutes of this movie.
Mm-hmm. And they're both by the guy, the ticket taker.
Yeah, the ticket taker at the train station. Nothing else is said. And, you know, Harmonica shows up, and then he has one of the most badass lines ever of, or when, you know, Frank's men say, looks like we're one horse short, and he just rebuttals with, looks like you got two horses too many. Mm-hmm. Like, you know everything you need to know about this character right there. Does it? He's morally ambiguous. We know that because this is a Western. But, like, he's clearly a badass. Because that's the first thing he's saying in this entire movie.
Yeah.
And then we get the scene where we have this family and it looks all nice and everything. And the girls just die. Yeah. And you're like, okay, well, at least the kid's spared because he's in the house. Then he comes out. I was like, you're going to do with the kid, Frank? Well, you said my name, so I have to kill him.
I have to kill him. Like, you have your protagonist, and you have your villain right off the bat. And the funny thing is, Claudia Cardinale is the first build in this movie, and Jason Robards hasn't even shown up yet.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. I didn't realize until watching it this time when those beautiful spaghetti Western credits are coming up. The story for this is written by Leone Bernardo Bertolucci and Dario Argento.
Yeah.
Those are some pretty big names in film.
Well, and it's funny because go look at the other things Dario Argento has done and go look at the other things Bernardo Bertolucci has done and then tell me how the hell they were the co-writers on this movie. But essentially, so I was reading a little bit about the story of this because I actually bought the DVD ahead of this, the Blu-ray, or not just a regular DVD. But I bought it ahead of this and I was reading something about the story, and the story was saying that Leone didn't want to make any more Westerns. He was done. And that's why he eventually goes on and makes Once Upon a Time in the West. He didn't want to make any more Westerns. And then Paramount really wanted him to do it. So he reached out to Argento and Bertolucci and was like, we got to come up with a plot. And this is what they came up with. And you can tell that this is three guys sitting around saying, what's our plot? Because it is convoluted. Like, do not get me wrong. Like, this is not a Charlie Kaufman script where you're sitting there going, well, damn, how did he come up with, like, this is a convoluted spaghetti Western of betrayals and nonsense and whatever. But think about the things you're seeing in this movie. You got Harmonica. You got Jason Robards, Cheyenne with the things. You got Claudia Cardinale, who's one of the probably the best female characters in a Western ever. Probably up there, like Natalie Wood in The Searchers is pretty epic too, even though she's a much smaller role. Yeah. But this is an amazing group. And then you have the villain, obviously, and Henry Fonda. And then you get into the side characters. And you have the guy who has tuberculosis of the bones. And on his private train that he drives around, the guy who really is the engine behind all of this, the one who sends Frank out to scare them so he can get the property because he knows what's going on. He's got to bring down his little thing so he can walk and get from place to place. Those decisions and those little things are what make this special. Because it's not, oh, we're good at poker. They don't play poker in this. They play poker one time, and it's when he says, let me deal. And he deals out $500 to every single one of them. It's an epic scene. Like, that is freaking awesome. And it goes away from, like, those types of tropes of what make people badass and gets into this different style, but so memorable. You're not going to forget these characters after you watch this movie one time.
Yeah, and the important part about these characters is, like, yes, Frank's a despicable character, but every other character has, like, the good side of them and the bad side of them and these, like, good traits, bad traits, and they're just so morally ambiguous. And that is what the West was. It truly was. They call it the Wild West for a reason.
Yeah.
But because, and that's what we're seeing, is we're seeing the dream to have this station built. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't to sell it and make money. It was just to have it and be a part of it. And when we finally get to that point at the conclusion of this film, and we see Harmonica and Cheyenne leave, it's because they can't fit in that society. They're not members of that society. Mm-hmm. These types of characters, it's a very common Western trope. Yeah. The heroes of Westerns don't hang around at the end. They always have to go off into the sunset because they just don't fit.
Yeah, a great example. I don't know. Have you seen High Noon or no?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, like Gary Cooper's character in that.
Yeah.
He's going out to stand up to the bad guys at the end of that movie because what else is he going to do? Like, that is his role. Like, that is what he was put in that town to do. And so, therefore, he must go ahead and do it. And, like, Cheyenne ends up dying. Spoilers, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you should know there's going to be spoilers. But Cheyenne ends up dying, and it's actually kind of heartbreaking because he left behind the girl to go and die. And what's Harmonica going to do? There's nothing for Harmonica to do. But what I also love about this movie is you never really know Harmonica's true motivations. You just know he really hates Frank. Yeah. And you don't know why. And it's a great revenge storyline that isn't the main driving point of the plot. Because so many movies are revenge, revenge, revenge. We see that family get killed. It's not like I keep calling her Claudia Cardinale. What is her character's name? Jill. It's not like Jill is now trying to get revenge the rest of the time. Sure, she wants it, but that's not what the driving force of this movie is. Harmonica wants revenge, but that's not the driving force of this movie. Jason Robards wants revenge because he's trying to be set up for this, but that's not the driving point of this movie. The driving point of this movie is the guy behind the scenes going to succeed and be able to take over this land? And I love the auction scene, which if somebody could please tell me the name of the actor who plays the auctioneer. I know he is an actor who I've seen in other movies, but he's not credited in this movie, as is like 87% of the cast. Most of the people aren't credited. And it was driving me crazy because I couldn't remember why I knew who he was, but I knew who he was. But all of that to say, we see the bad guys about to win. And we see somebody tries to, you don't want to do that. And then Charles Bronson just comes in. He's like, $5,000. Boom. And now it's like, okay, he's finally getting his showdown with Frank, and he still won't tell Frank who he is until the very, very end of the movie. It's awesome.
And the better part about that, too, is Harmonica is turning in Cheyenne to get the money to buy that land. Mm-hmm. And it feels like this betrayal. Like, you're like, oh, is this the plan? And it's like, ooh, I think he actually is betraying him here.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it leads you to just follow this character. Now, you know, you're even more invested. Okay. So Harmonica's betraying this person he's been working with. Why? What is between Harmonica and Frank? Mm-hmm. And then he has this prime opportunity with Frank's men being turned on him because they've been paid off to do so. And he still helps Frank to survive it because he wants Frank himself.
Mm-hmm.
It has that revenge plot, but it's built up so much more because it also has that moral high ground of like wanting to help Jill succeed despite the fact that she, you know, lost her entire family, and find the Nick Bane's dream and build it for him, because it also ruins Frank's day.
Because it ruins Frank's. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. It's what's also crazy though is this was coming at a time where these Westerns had started to fall out. Like, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly came out in 66, but pretty much if Clint Eastwood wasn't in your Western, you didn't have it going. And Clint Eastwood turned down this movie. He didn't want to be in it. So you take Henry Fonda, who, you know, was still a really big name, don't get me wrong, but Henry Fonda was bigger in the 40s. 12 Angry Men was 11 years before this. So all of a sudden, Henry Fonda he's kind of becoming a little bit like not so well known anymore. Like, people would still know his name, but it didn't mean as much. So he has to go against type and play a villain. And you think Henry Fonda takes a chance on a dying genre, which this is kind of turning into a rap a little bit, but takes a chance on a dying genre to play against type with Jason Robards, who was well before he was going to become famous and win back-to-back Oscars, one that he deserved and one that is the worst Best Supporting Actor not win ever. And when Charles Bronson was like, what? Charles Bronson is one of those actors who I feel like is more of a household name than he probably should be. He's in The Great Escape, so like, you know, he does have that going for him, and The Magnificent Seven, The Dirty Dozen. Like, he was in a lot of movies, but he was never the star of them. Yeah. So Henry Fonda is now going to be the star of this movie, even though Claudia Cardinale is still top billed because of all the other movies she was in. But he's going to be the star of this movie as the villain in a dying genre with a director that doesn't want to make Westerns anymore. You add all that up and somehow get what I believe is the greatest Western of all time. Like, that's just,
yeah,
it's interesting. Cause this is 68. Mm-hmm. Name good Westerns that came out after 68 that were American produced. Like, this is a Paramount picture. What's a good Western that came out after 1968 that's American produced? You could get all the way to 2010 and get True Grit. I know that the other True Grit came out not long after this, but that was John Wayne's like sayonara.
I guess 92 Unforgiven.
Yeah, that might be it. And there you go.
It's a Clint Eastwood movie.
And it's a Clint Eastwood movie. So you're coming back with Clint Eastwood because True Grit was the year after this, but at least like the original one, but True Grit is much more of like a, hey, let's just like love John Wayne, you know?
Yeah.
I gotta see. I'm gonna look up American Westerns of the 70s. See what I'm missing. But you know, and what's funny is this movie was not popular. It wasn't popular at all when it came out. It didn't get Oscar noms, it was nothing.
I mean, part of that has to do with the fact that it's an Italian film. And like the Italian films had that reputation of just being like, you know, they're being made in Italy because it's cheaper to make them in Italy. I mean, we talked about it with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Well, why these films are being made and everything. But I don't know how you could watch this film and not see it as a masterpiece. Like, this is a movie that is ending up in my next iteration of my top 100. Mm-hmm. This, it's a genre-defining movie for me. Mm-hmm. It's just masterfully created. The sound design in this movie is impeccable. Mm-hmm. That first scene where the father and son come back, like where McBain comes back to the farmstead and the cicadas all of a sudden stop. You're like, oh no, something bad's going to happen. And then the cicadas start again. It's like, okay, maybe they're just being paranoid. And then it stops again and they all die. That's brilliant sound design.
Yeah.
The windmill scraping in that first scene. And it's like, all you hear, brilliant sound design. And then you throw in the phenomenal score on top of it all. Every aspect of this film was just firing on all cylinders the entire time. It's impossible to deny how good it is.
Yeah. No, I love like the cicadas and everything like that. I think that really adds. And pretty much if you look up 70s Westerns, you're finding Clint Eastwood, John Wayne, you know, The Cowboys, which is a 72 movie, and you got The Outlaw Josie Wales. There is McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is the Robert Altman movie. But that's, I don't feel like that's as much of like a household name when people are talking about Westerns. You're talking, I mean, you have to think before this, you had The Magnificent Seven, Shane, The Searchers, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, For a Few Dollars More. Like, there were so many that were hitting the mainstream that Once Upon a Time in the West, like, didn't even hit that. Once Upon a Time in the West has built up a cult following over the years because of how great it is and because of Leone's name. But that took that long, and maybe YouTube can get like a good blocker here. Like, I'm confused, YouTube. Like, do you guys have nothing? Are you like that? Like, you can't block somebody from changing their thing by one name? Like, are you kidding me? Anyway, I just think maybe YouTube could get on that. But you go like 1980s Westerns, there's really like nothing. There's nothing. And then it finally gets to Unforgiven. But this was so popular, and it started to become less popular because the amazingness of the West wasn't really there anymore. The unknown, the wildness, all that, it wasn't there as much. Like with Gunsmoke in the 50s, like people were still traveling west at that point. Hollywood was there, but what was in between? And
yeah, but you can still ask that question nowadays, Phil.
Well, no, you can. I've driven across it numerous times. But the South is still more built up than the North, that's for sure. If you're going to Arizona, New Mexico, you're going to see some things. If you're going, you know, Idaho and then South Dakota, you're not going to see anything. But all of that is to say, like, this movie, I think, does also capture the loneliness and kind of the nostalgia for a West that really wasn't. Like, there is a nostalgia to this movie, and I think the score really nails that nostalgia, but there's a nostalgia to this of an era of film that's kind of gone now, and of these types of heroes and stuff. There's, in this movie, there's one, you know, comment about Native Americans. One. If this movie was made 5 years earlier, those are the bad guys.
Yeah.
Almost every other American produced Western, those are the bad guys. But this movie doesn't do that. And I think it was kind of this shift, but also this looking back and this longing and this isolation movie. There's a lot of depth to this movie for a genre that really isn't well known for its depth.
Yeah. And I mean, you have to look at the other Westerns that were coming out in this game, because like this was the time where we were really looking at the end of the West, right? Mm-hmm. And so Leone's up there with like other movies that were kind of similar, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and the Wild Bunch. They're like focusing on the end of the West, whereas Leone hasn't quite gotten to that point yet. Like, yes, he's looking back on the West, but it's not like the turnover to that new era just yet. Mm-hmm. And that's why it almost feels nostalgic when you watch this film. Mm-hmm. And like, that's what drives it and makes it so good. And that's why you can sit there for 15 minutes without anyone saying a word and be like, oh yeah, this is what the Wild West was like.
Yeah. Have you, now here's my question. Have you seen The Wild Bunch?
I have.
Yeah. That's a wild movie.
Yeah.
No pun intended. That is a pretty crazy movie. Pretty violent, obviously not going to seem violent nowadays because, you know, obviously like, we've seen like so much blood and guts and stuff, but like for the time that like blew people's minds, and that came out a year after this. But again, like it's a perfect point. It's the end of the West. Like it's this, even that movie, it's about old people. Henry Fonda's old in this movie. Charles Bronson looks weathered in this movie. James Coburn is old in this movie. Claudia Cardinale is the only thing that looks good in this entire movie. Like, but that's so purposeful. You can see that it's purposeful. Everybody else is withering away. They're wasting away. They're doing things that are dated, and they almost know it's dated. Like when Henry Fonda is talking to the guy with tuberculosis saying, why are you, like, anybody else would have put a bullet in their head. And it's like, yeah, but that's the only thing he knows how to do is keep going and live with the pain. Who cares? And Henry Fonda is sitting there wasting his time with this guy in hopes of getting a little payday. Why? You know, it's just like those questions. And I don't know. It kind of like leads to like the whole pointlessness of so much of like what made the West the West. And and then you have Claudia Cardinale, who's just like, yeah, I'm stuck in it. I'm just stuck in the middle of it while everybody else is getting old and falling apart.
And that's the big thing about her character too, right? Like it said right away that she's from New Orleans. Like she isn't from the West. She's not part of the West. And she intentionally kind of sticks out there because of that.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, she's New Orleans, and that one guy loves that she's from New Orleans and wants to talk to her about it all the time.
Yeah, that one guy sure changed something else. Mood.
I'm telling you. I also love that as soon as Cheyenne comes in, they have that whole scene. He gets like nervous for a second. As soon as the guy walks out, right back to flirting with her. Let's go.
Yeah.
Love it. No time wasted. None. But again, going to Morricone's score, I also love the one that ends the movie, like the walking score. It's so funny because I love playing the Final Fantasy games, and in Final Fantasy X, there's a score in DeJose, I think, like when they're in that world or that part of the world, and it's so reminiscent of this like walking thing, and it's just such a great like traveling score. A great traveling soundtrack, but it's almost like silly and fun. And then you have this beautiful score, and like Morricone just like, I mean, just knocks it out of the park with this one. It's my favorite one. You know, I've seen a bunch of movies of his, like even like the lesser known ones, like The Mission, which also has a great score. But like this one for me, just like it tugs at the heartstrings. And the main score for this was in my Spotify top 100 last year. And it was in like the top 30, because I just love listening to it. It's something I'll just throw on. It just gets you thinking, and it's hard not to think like when you have that on.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal score. I don't think there's many scores that perfectly capture a film as well as this one does, where it perfectly just encapsulates exactly who these characters are and exactly the themes that are going on screen as it plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, John, you have anything else for Once Upon a Time in the West?
Watch it so you could just watch Westerns. Because yeah, you can't really watch Westerns until you watch this movie.
It just makes it easier. And it's not like, I mean, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is long. Like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is very, very long. I don't know. I think this is actually a very accessible Western. Although, like I said, that Bandidos movie, check that one out too, because that's a very accessible Western and might get you more into it. But it's a 2.5 hour, like, just takes its time, gets to where it's going, and does it in a great fashion with great acting and really cool characters.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that payoff when you finally do find out Harmonica's motives, it's just so worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That scene is great. That scene is all I could think of now, though, is James Franco in freaking Ballad of Buster Scruggs saying first time. That's all I could think the entire time. It was brutal. But all right. Well, anyway, so next week we are going into number 31, which is The Godfather for John and Rosemary's Baby for me. But I have The Godfather higher up, so we'll be talking about Goodfellas instead. So we're going to be doing Goodfellas and Rosemary's Baby, my second movie in a row from 1968, which Once Upon a Time in the West was my highest ranked Western. Rosemary's Baby is my highest ranked pure horror movie, because Psycho is a horror movie, but Psycho is also more of like a thriller type thing. Yeah. So this is like my top pure horror movie. And then when we get up to Space Odyssey and Planet of the Apes, they're probably that's my highest ranked sci-fi movie and my highest ranked B movie that really Planet of the Apes is. But anyway, so that's what we'll be doing next week, Rosemary's Baby and Goodfellas. Remember, we do have a Discord, so if you're interested in talking movies with us, come on over, be a patron for $1. Obviously, a lot of the content is Survivor-related, but we do have a Movie Buffs channel on the Discord, so it's worth your while if you're into that. Other than that, we'll see you next week. Gotta hit end.